This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, Congress calls on Boeing to testify on 737 MAX crashes, plus earnings from the retail sector. I'm John Tucker in New York.
I'm Amy Morris in Washington. Is the nation really in a constitutional crisis?
And I'm Caroline Hepke in London, where we're looking ahead to German GDP figures for the first quarter.
I'm Danielle Bokov in Toronto. After years of belt tightening, M&A in the energy sector is back. And everyone, including Warren Buffett, wants a piece of the action.
And in Asia, what are Tencent and Alibaba getting up to in terms of their earnings? I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm John Tucker, and we begin today's program with a preview of U.S. retail earnings due out next week. Walmart and Macy's report as brick-and-mortar stores see pressure to perform. And joining me now to discuss, Bloomberg Stocks reporter Sarah Ponczyk and Bloomberg Stock Market columnist Dave Wilson. I suppose we should take a look at the earnings season so far, Dave and Sarah. 441 companies out of the 500 in the S&P 500 have reported so far. And so far, with if you measure it by success with the positive earnings surprises, 331 of those companies have had positive earnings surprises. So far.
Story really, John, is that analysts went into first quarter reporting anticipating that S&P 500 would be lower profit, and it's not. I mean, you were close to a 4% decline when companies started reporting based on analyst estimates that we compiled here at Bloomberg. And now it's looking like, by the time all is said and done, you'll be somewhere in the vicinity of maybe 2% growth. So, that's quite a reversal on top of what we saw in terms of...
Well, the comparisons were pretty difficult, too.
Well, they were made much more difficult than usual in the sense of how far down the numbers came during the first quarter. So,
Sarah,
really,
what happened to the earnings recession?
It's
not
no
that I was
longer
looking forward to it.
At least in the first quarter. I mean, the phrase that we keep on hearing is better than feared. We are supposed to see growth now in the first quarter. Now, we should note that guidance and some forecasts for the second quarter, the quarter that we are technically currently in, those have come down, and now we are expecting slightly negative growth there. I mean, it's about negative half of a percentage point. So it's not a lot by any means, but we are still looking for that hockey stick fourth quarter gain. And especially considering what has happened in the past week as it relates to trade, I have heard from many strategists who are now talking about the fourth quarter and saying, well, with higher tariffs, if this keeps going on, then that could be an issue for the fourth quarter earnings season. But still, first quarter, not nearly as bad as people were expecting.
Okay. Every time I've counted out the U.S. consumer out of the picture, I've been dead wrong, because the U.S. consumer always comes bouncing back no matter what. So we're going to get, the pulse of the consumer coming up.
We'll start to. I mean, it's going to be a process that will unfold over the next maybe 2 or 3 weeks, because it's just a matter of the timing in terms of numbers coming out. And you've got to remember that the typical fiscal year for a retailer is a month behind the calendar. So we're looking at results for their fiscal first quarters ended in April. As you mentioned, Macy's and Walmart kind of kicked things off. And, talk about two companies that are representative of the broader industry. I mean, they're reasonably good examples. Of course, Walmart being the biggest retailer, and yet at the same time increasingly trying to compete with Amazon.com in the online retailing world. And then Macy's, well, you're looking at a traditional department store, and certainly a company that has struggled over time to try and figure out how to deal with this new world driven by all the online shopping brought on by the success of Amazon.
And I will add that Macy's has been dealing with its own issues, especially as a department store in the United States.
Idiosyncratic?
Idiosyncratic.
That's the word.
Yes. But we hear it all the time. And with Macy's, I mean, you look at the shares this year, they're down more than 20%. And Bloomberg Intelligence does track some data that looks at department store traffic. And based off the data so far this year, they are estimating that we probably will see some sustained weakness. So we might not see a reprieve just yet for Macy's. And then as it relates to Walmart as well, you think about a store like Walmart, what they're really known for is their price competitiveness. Well, just this past week, Wolf Research actually came out and downgraded the stock, saying that we might be seeing their prices actually start to be ticking higher, and that could eat away at their competitiveness.
We also get the semis, right? Semiconductors?
Well, yeah, we get some because you've got NVIDIA in terms of chip makers, and then you've got Applied Materials, the biggest producer of chip-making equipment. So, you know, both those sets of results due out after the close on Thursday. And it'll be interesting just to kind of get these companies' sense of where the business is, given what Intel had to say this past week. Their CEO, Bob Swan, making his first appearance at an investor conference since taking the top job in January, basically looking 3 years out and saying, we're anticipating low single-digit revenue growth on a percentage basis at Intel, and that struck people as disappointing because if you looked at the analyst numbers, by the time you get 3 years out, they were calling for 5% revenue growth on average. And, you know, that sort of dovetails with what's been going on lately with the chip stocks, the whole idea of people kind of getting excited about the possibility of a recovery.
Okay. Thanks, guys, for getting us a little smarter on that. Our thanks to Bloomberg Stocks reporter Sarah Ponczyk and Bloomberg Stock Market columnist Dave Wilson. Just ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, the earnings continue to roll in from China's tech titans, with Alibaba and Tencent reporting next week. I'm John Tucker, and this is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm John Tucker in New York. Just ahead, later in our program, the euro area growth picture, as Germany expects its weakest expansion in 6 years. But first, let's turn to China now, where two of Asia's largest publicly traded companies report earnings. Bloomberg Daybreak Asia anchor Brian Curtis has more.
John, we have two big earnings reports coming up in the next week from Chinese tech and e-commerce companies. And these reports are going to say a lot about the confidence of the Chinese consumer and about how well these companies are managing their businesses. It's Tencent and Alibaba, two of the most important Chinese companies, the former listed in Hong Kong, the latter in New York. And joining me now for what we might expect from these companies is Bloomberg's Wei Sernling, senior industry analyst covering the Internet. Wei, thanks very much for coming in. So let's start off with Alibaba. The shares are up 32% this year, so it seems like investors are not all that concerned with the weaker revenue growth that we saw last quarter or even the U.S.-China trade war. Why?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is that Alibaba gave out its full-year fiscal 2019 guidance some time ago, and they haven't revised that. And if you take that guidance on its face value, it's actually implying an acceleration in sales growth in the coming quarter. Last quarter, they delivered 41% sales growth, and if you, in order to meet the bottom end of the guidance that they've met, which they've not changed, they've got to have sales growth of 48% in the coming quarter. So I think the market may take that as a positive signal.
Yeah, even with the gains, though, Baba is down over the past year. Mm-hmm. So there clearly are some challenges. What are chief among them?
Yeah, I think, for Baba, one thing is the e-commerce market. It has reached a certain level of maturity in China. The breakneck growth that we've seen in the last couple of years is probably not going to come back. There is also that sentiment that's slightly negative for Alibaba because it's exposed to commerce, and commerce is impacted by the trade war. So people consume less, advertisers spend less, for Alibaba, advertising is the bulk of their revenue. So there's some impact there.
Let's switch over to Tencent for a couple of minutes here. Tencent has been held back somewhat by regulatory considerations in China with the game approvals. But that is sort of clearing now, isn't it?
Yes. So the approvals restarted in December, and the pace of approvals right now is still slow, but new games are coming through. And what's really positive for Tencent is they've launched a new game in March. It's called Perfect World, and that game in March is actually generating as much sales as their flagship game Honor of Kings, which is really huge, right? So I think in the first quarter, we will actually see a sequential rebound in their mobile game revenues, which will be taken positively by the market.
And just in the past week or so, we've seen them stop offering in China the best-selling video, yes, this PlayerUnknown's Battleground. So yes, what's the significance of that?
Yeah, so PUBG, or PlayerUnknown's Battleground, is a really popular game in China and globally as well. But Tencent has never received approval from the government to monetize these titles. So it's free to play. They can't sell anything within the game. So what they've done is they have suspended PUBG, and they have released a new game concurrently called Game for Peace, which is essentially the same as PUBG. But this new game did receive an approval in April from the government for monetization. So I think this is positive for the company. They will be able to start generating sales from this very, very popular genre.
Wei, thank you very much. Bloomberg's Wei Sern Ling, senior industry analyst covering the internet. I'm Brian Curtis here in Hong Kong, along with Doug Krisner normally in New York, and you can catch us every weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 6 a.m. in Hong Kong and 6 p.m. on Wall Street. John?
All right, thanks, Brian. And let's head to the commodity space now and dig deeper into the bidding war for Anadarko Petroleum. For that, we turn to Bloomberg's Danielle Bokov in Toronto. Danielle, hello.
The battle for Anadarko Petroleum is indicative of a larger trend. After years of self-imposed austerity, the energy sector seems to be readying itself for a wave of M&A in the United States, driven by the expansion of the Permian Basin, which is the world's largest oil patch. Bloomberg's Simon Casey joins me. Thanks for coming on, Simon.
Thank you for having me.
This Anadarko takeover saga has absolutely transfixed the sector. It has everything. It's massive, incredible, intricate strategy on by one of the bidders, people tracking corporate jets. It sent such a jolt through the sector.
It really has. It's on course to be the largest deal in about 4 years in the oil industry, and it's pitted two big companies here in the U.S. to fight over this other company. And as you point out, there's a lot of jets flying around, deals being struck on the side, including funding that was secured by Occidental at the last moment with Warren Buffett, $10 billion to help sweeten their deal and get it across the finishing line. Let's hear what Vicky Holub, the CEO of Occidental, has got to say.
It's very rare, in fact generational, when you see an opportunity like this come along where you can check every box that you want to check for from a value standpoint.
As she's pointing out there, it is quite a seminal moment in the oil industry here in the U.S. We haven't had large-scale M&A really for some time, and after a period of austerity and cost cuts and companies being very, very focused on returning cash to shareholders, there's concern that this could mark an uptick in deals, but maybe, you know, a return to some of the more sort of bad habits of the past where companies were pursuing big deals at the expense of shareholders' interests.
In terms of consolidation that could happen, how fragmented is the playing field?
It's pretty fragmented. If you look at a map of the Permian Basin, it's some people who work down there refer to it as like a checkerboard, which makes it difficult for operators down there to find as much efficiency gains as they could. So plus, it's a booming region. There's a lot of interest from Chevron, from Exxon, even from Shell and other major players to get more involved down in there and get a piece of the action.
So very quickly, Simon, anything else on the horizon to rival this one? Who might be next?
There are a whole bunch of mid-sized players that are perhaps not so well known out of the United States. The names that keep cropping up: Pioneer Resources, Concho, Parsley, Diamondback, that are frackers. They've been involved down in the Permian for a long time, and they could be takeover targets. They could even be, you know, candidates to sort of combine amongst themselves and become sort of established major second-tier players here in the U.S.
Simon, thank you very much. That's what we're watching this week in commodities in Toronto. I'm Danielle Bokov.
Thanks, Danielle. And just ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, the European Commission slashes its growth forecast for Germany with warnings of escalating trade tension. I'm John Tucker. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Radio Plus app and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm John Tucker in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. Up later on the program, Boeing is back in a spotlight on Capitol Hill. But first, let's head to Europe, where German GDP for the first quarter comes out on Wednesday. And for a preview, let's head to London and bring in Bloomberg Europe Daybreak anchor Caroline Hepker.
John, the German government slashed its 2019 growth outlook last month and is now expecting the weakest expansion in 6 years, whilst the European Commission cut its growth forecast for the euro area and slashed its projection for Germany as it warned that escalating trade tensions threaten to make the outlook even worse. But is it as bad as those numbers suggest? Well, joining me now is Bloomberg senior euro area economist David Palv. What do you expect then to see from the GDP figures?
Well, we already have a good idea of what that number is going to be, and that's because the euro area has already released an aggregate figure, and we also have the numbers for France, Italy, and Spain. So we can back out what the number is going to be for Germany. It's probably going to be about 0.4%, which is very strong relative to what many people were expecting just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, so why were those figures so gloomy then?
Well, those figures were so gloomy because we had a series of very bad surveys come out of Germany. In particular, the manufacturing PMI survey reached a level it hadn't seen since the height of the euro crisis. But there's a disconnect right now between the surveys, that soft data and the hard data, and that happens from time to time, even though in general, they do tend to be good indicators.
How do the trade tensions, persistent tensions, play into that growth picture?
Well, the European Commission warned when it released its recent forecasts that trade tensions pose a great risk to the euro area economy, and that is indeed true. For the moment, most of the trade dispute between the United States and Germany has been nothing but words. There has been no real concrete action. But the U.S. president has threatened the German car industry with tariffs in the future. And that's an area of the economy that's already had a lot of difficulty over the course of the last year when it had to implement new auto emission standards. And any tariffs would be another blow that would have a major impact on the German economy and, by extension, the euro area economy as a whole.
And what do the growth figures then, in your view, mean for the European Central Bank, the ECB?
Well, the ECB is going to be very happy with the strong data that we had for the first quarter. It was unexpectedly strong, stronger than they had anticipated, and as stronger than the market as a whole had anticipated. And what that means is any talk of stimulus at their next meeting is going to be off the table. The tone of the conversation is going to be very different from the last time they met. And something else they'll be considering is the terms of the next round of long-term loans that they're going to be offering. And the debate previously had been, should they be as generous as they were last time, or should the attractiveness be reduced in order to reduce the dependency of the banking sector on the ECB. And in all likelihood, that will push them toward the direction of making those loans a bit less attractive and encouraging banks to go out to the money markets to get funding.
The picture for Germany looks reasonably strong then, but that's not the case in other parts of the Eurozone.
Indeed, the number for Germany was boosted by construction activity in the first quarter, and that may not persist. So what we can generally say is moving ahead, those risks still remain. We may not have a quarter of growth in the second quarter that's as strong as the first. But what the good news is that we still seem to be moving back toward where the ECB would like the economy to be operating, and that is close to its potential rate of growth. And that would be in sharp contrast to the last several quarters of last year.
in terms of the trade tensions. Of course, there's this issue still remaining with tariffs on auto parts, and we don't know anything about that yet. Quite quiet on the trade front when it comes to Europe at the moment.
Yeah, most of the trade tensions and talks have been focused on the dispute between China and the United States, and that may be resolved sometime soon. But the issue with Germany remains on the back burner. Every so often, Donald Trump mentions it again as something that upsets him, and that is certainly far from disappearing.
Is there anything that Europe can do, I suppose, to prepare, to gird its loins in terms of potential trade difficulties with China or the U.S.?
The euro area is more vulnerable than many countries to trade tensions, and that's because it has one of the largest trade surpluses in the world. In particular, Germany contributes hugely to that. And the only way to reduce that dependency in the long term is to stoke domestic demand and be less dependent on external demand moving ahead. But that's a long-term structural shift and nothing that's going to change over the course of one quarter or two.
That was Bloomberg senior euro area economist David Powell joining me. I'm Caroline Hepke in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here on Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. John.
Thanks, Caroline. Just ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, we pivot to Washington as the House Transportation Committee holds a hearing on Boeing's troubled 737 MAX jet. I'm John Tucker, and this is Bloomberg. And this is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm John Tucker here in New York. And just ahead, Boeing is back in the spotlight. This will be on Capitol Hill. But first, let's head to our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington to see what items in politics and government are set to top the agenda next week. And for that, we bring in Amy Morris, host of our Politics, Policy, Power, and Law program, heard weekdays at noon on Bloomberg Radio. Amy.
Thank you, John. Democrats are calling this a constitutional crisis.
We've talked for a long time about approaching a constitutional crisis. We are now in it.
That's House Judiciary Chair Gerald Nadler. He says President Trump's assertion of executive privilege over the Mueller report is an escalation of his administration's blanket defiance of Congress. It's not just the House's fight with the Justice Department over the release of Special Counsel Mueller's report. And both sides are digging in. Let's get more on this from Bloomberg News Managing Editor Michael Shepard. Michael, I want to thank you for taking the time with us. So, are we in a constitutional crisis?
Well, there are some people out there who are wondering whether we're heading in that direction. I don't think we're quite there yet. Really, we are seeing an intensifying confrontation between President Donald Trump and congressional Democrats over the Mueller report. The president is trying to do everything he can to keep the unredacted version of this report from the special counsel from getting into Democrats' hands. But the House Judiciary Committee has already voted in favor of finding Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress for failing to heed its demands for a full unredacted version of the special counsel's report, along with a bunch of underlying documents.
So, you know, Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi has said that the president's just goading lawmakers and that he actually is trying to create a constitutional crisis. He wants this.
Well, the president, for his part, would say that this information, these documents don't pertain to Congress, that everything that lawmakers need to see and know came in the form of the report that the attorney general delivered. But a number of people have looked at that report and say the conclusions in here raise even more questions than the report answers. And we'd like to see what led the special counsel to make his decisions and inform what he said regarding obstruction and about whether the president engaged in a conspiracy to work with Russia for winning the election. In both cases, special counsel concluded that, A, there was no evidence of any sort of conspiracy, not enough to warrant prosecution, and there wasn't enough either on the obstruction side, although he did leave open the question for Congress to take up. And that's why lawmakers want to see more of this underlying documentation.
Yeah, there had been some talk that Mueller might be appearing on Capitol Hill as early as this coming week. Yeah, what have you heard lately?
Well, the latest is that even though there has been some discussion about bringing him before lawmakers, he is still in office as special counsel. And until he leaves, it would be hard for him to make the appearance without having to somehow do a check with William Barr, who would it would be very unlikely for him to say, sure, go ahead and show up.
Okay, so we won't be watching for that, and maybe we shouldn't be watching for Donald Trump Jr. either, even though he was subpoenaed to appear before, and let's make it clear, a Republican-led Senate panel. It doesn't look like he's going to show up for that either.
It doesn't look like he's going to show up, or at least not anytime soon. They want him to respond to testimony by the president's former fixer, Michael Cohen, on a Trump Tower project in Moscow that was never built. The whole matter is driving a wedge between some Senate Republicans and the panel's Republican chairman, Richard Burr, who, as it happens, is not planning to seek re-election in 2022.
And let's shift to Moscow for just a moment. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, goes there. What is the goal of this trip?
Well, it's a very quick trip. He is leaving at the end of the weekend and arriving there on Monday. It will be a quick stop. On Tuesday, he will get to meet with his counterpart, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and Russian President Vladimir Putin. They're due to meet actually in the resort city of Sochi after Pompeo's stop in Moscow. They'll have a lot to talk about. The top two agenda items will be Ukraine and Venezuela. On Ukraine, the U.S. wants Russia to ease freedom of navigation on the Azov Sea for Ukrainian and other vessels. The issue is that Russia has been clamping down on Ukrainian ships that have been transiting in those waters. More urgently, from the U.S. perspective, the administration wants Russia to end its support for Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. is blaming Russian support in part for Maduro's ability to stay in power, even though the conditions in the countries we can see in Caracas are growing more dire by the day.
Okay, that's what we're going to be looking for the coming week. Bloomberg News Managing Editor Michael Shepard, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that is what is happening in the nation's capital. I'm Amy Morris. You can catch me every weekday on Bloomberg Politics, Policy, Power, and Law at noon, Wall Street time, on Bloomberg Radio. John.
All right, thanks, Amy. Also in Washington this week, aviation regulators head to Capitol Hill for hearings on the 737 MAX following two fatal crashes by the Boeing aircraft. And joining me now is Bloomberg opinion columnist Brooke Sutherland. One of the things I find unusual about this, Brooke, is that the aviation regulator is going to be there from the National Transportation Safety Board and the Federal Aviation Administration, but not Boeing's CEO. Why is that?
Well, I mean, I think what Boeing has said is that the time is not right to send in the CEO because these investigations are still ongoing, and so their ability to fully answer lawmakers' questions is somewhat limited because they don't want to interfere with the investigation. Now, the counter argument to that would be that Congress has had no problem bringing in CEOs even when they're in the middle of investigations in the past. And obviously, you know, we've seen them haul in the bank CEOs very recently. So I do think it's interesting, and it does raise more questions, especially at a time when Boeing's relationship with the government and perhaps, you know, a little bit too much intimacy with the regulators that were meant to be overseeing it is very much in the spotlight.
So what do we know from the investigations by the National Transportation Safety Board and the other international agencies that oversee aviation?
So we haven't heard, you know, sort of an official report from actually the U.S. regulators at this point. What we do have is the preliminary investigation into the Ethiopian Airlines crash by local regulators there. Now, they said that they did get consensus from the FAA and when they put that out and other regulators around the globe. And sort of the conclusion that the regulatory investigations have come to at this point is that Boeing's so-called MCAS system was a factor on both plane crashes. And that's an anti-stall flight control system that was put into the 737 MAX to sort of help balance out the fact that they retrofitted this decades-old design to accommodate these new, more fuel-efficient engines. Those are bigger. They shift the center of the gravity for the airplane. And this system was meant to sort of balance everything back out. But it was dependent on only one sensor. And when that sensor was feeding in bad data, it could trigger a dive of those airplanes.
Were pilots adequately trained to go from the regular 737s to the 737 MAX that now had this feature?
So we've heard a lot of pushback from the pilots, even after the Lion Air crash. They did not feel like they were properly informed about this system and its capabilities. And it's since come out that airlines who thought that they had safety protocols that would have notified the pilots if those so-called angle of attack sensors that trigger this software system that we're talking about were getting erroneous data, if they were mismatched as far as what they were seeing, airlines thought that that was part of their 737 MAX that they bought. It turns out that was not necessarily the case, and they were not active on all of the planes, and that the airlines needed to have paid for an additional safety package in order for those to be activated. Now, that obviously has caused a lot of consternation, not only among the airlines, but also among the pilots, who just feel like they were maybe not properly prepared to deal with the system. Now, the question going forward, Boeing is working on an update to this software system that it says will remedy a lot of these problems and make the system dependent on two sensors, limit, you know, sort of the force with which it can push the plane's nose down. But the question is, do pilots need simulator training on that new system, or can they just do an iPad course? That there's a significant cost difference between the two.
Okay, so what is the FAA and NTSB officials, what is going to be the line of questioning for them from lawmakers, do you suppose?
So I think there's going to be a continuing focus on why the FAA was the last of the global regulatory bodies, essentially, to ground the MAX plane. Why didn't they choose to act more quickly? Why didn't they, you know, discover these problems before there were crashes? And I think there's obviously a lot of ongoing scrutiny about the FAA's relationship with Boeing, and specifically the outsourcing of regulatory work to Boeing employees. Now, that was done legally. That's part of the system that was put in place. It had lots of bipartisan support, but we're now seeing potentially some of the flaws in that system. So I expect there to be a lot of questions about that. That's something that, you know, regulators talked about extensively with the Senate when they held those hearings a few weeks ago. But I expect probably still more questions as we try to get to the bottom of that.
Where do we stand with the 737 MAX possibly returning to service? First of all, does any passenger want to fly on the aircraft, I suppose, would be a great question.
Well, I think there's sort of dual questions there. So what airlines have said at this point is they're not expecting to have the 737 MAX back in service until early to mid-August at the earliest. They've taken it out of the schedule through then. I think, you know, for all of the regulators to get on board and put this plane back up in the sky, you're probably looking more at like a September timeframe. But as you said, then there's a totally separate question of once the plane is, you know, legally allowed to fly, will passengers actually want to get on it? And I think what's interesting is that this is really sort of the first incident that we've seen with a significant plane crash happening in the social media era, and at a time when services like Kayak are readily available and customers can screen for flights based on the type of airplane flying. And so I think that the turnaround, the acceptance by the public may be more difficult this time around than in the past.
Brooke, always a pleasure. Appreciate it. That's Bloomberg Opinion columnist Brooke Sutherland. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning, 5 a.m. Wall Street time, for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm John Tucker, and this is Bloomberg.